Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Everybody, welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott.
Hello, Josh Brown. Let's do the games of the year, shall we?
Well, there's been some games this year, has there?
There's been two or three, you might call them, you know, just a few little things barely escaping for air in between these various video games. Even as we record this, I'm looking forward to the AEW game. That's in a couple of days. I keep mentioning this, hoping that some sort of free copy will arrive, but it hasn't yet.
The amount of AEW clips,
the
game clips that you have liked is outrageous.
Yeah.
It keeps popping up on my Twitter. Every single day. I feel like I'm being subjected to it like Alex in A Clockwork Orange, eyes peeled up and looking at people getting put through tables.
Someday you'll start watching The Product and then you'll really start liking it. There was a bit Forbidden Door was the other night.
Hey, it's funny you mention this. Few nights I've been getting into wrestling video essays, which our boys should do, to be honest. I want to watch video essays done by them.
We do
because
some.
I've been jumping into just behind the scenes stuff, which I've always been quite fascinated in how that company works.
Dark Side of the Ring.
Podcast on it and stuff. So, you know what? I'm in the...
You're in, man.
As much as I can be in a wrestling mood, I'm in a wrestling mood.
I would recommend Forbidden Door, which was the crossover between AEW and NJPW, the New Japan Wrestling organization. But this is a gaming podcast, and we should talk about the best games of the year. We both have 10 picks. They are entirely subjective. I don't know what your picks are. You don't know what mine are. And we're just going to alternate back and forward. I will start with my number 10.
Go on.
Which is Aka R, a game that is, I guarantee... six people will have heard of. This is from Jeff Minter, the dude that created Tempest back in the day, one of Atari's genius minds, nicknamed Yak. Did a version of Aka R back in the day, but it didn't make the light of day in the 70s or the 80s or whatever. Dude continued to make various versions of Tempest and various versions of games that did come out on Atari systems. And then for whatever reason, Aka R just came together. It was kind of because of the whole Atari revival project that's happening. Last year, there was a compilation of games called Atari 50, which just told the whole story of the company back from the 70s all the way till now, including various talking head segments and whatever with the team. And I love that thing. That made me realize just how important all those people were, how important Atari were. Not that I didn't know it massively before, but getting it in like a proper documentary style where they refer to games in conversation and then you can just pause and play them. I think that's brilliant. I think all archival stuff should be presented like that. And then Jeff Minter putting out Aka R in 2023 as this, like, what he would have done kind of thing, or what he always wanted to do. There was like a version of it that released and you can play it on in the Atari 50 collection, but Aka R on Switch is the new one.
What a fascinating history.
It's weird.
Because everything you just said there, you might as well have been talking in tongues. Like, what is Tempest? What is Atari? I don't know.
What are those things? What is Atari?
I just knew that would pop you. I just knew that would get you.
You would have played Chrono Trigger, so I'd be like, maybe, I don't know.
It's true. I've not played any of those games, to be fair, that you just mentioned. But I can respect something that is this long in the tooth.
Yeah.
storied finally releasing. The game itself, I did cheekily have a check of it when you mentioned it there. It looks not for me.
So I'll mention that that's the whole thing. The whole thing that Jeff Mint sort of prides himself on is a very simple set of game mechanics that are very Moorish. They're very just sort of immediately responsive and arcadey as hell. Like that was the... I think you would recognize Tempest if you saw it. He plays like a little yellow like creature and you're trying to defend the end of what looks like a tunnel and there are various creatures coming down the tunnel.
I'm Googling while you speak.
It was all like wireframe style. There are have been various versions made over the years. There's a version on the Jaguar that people say is the best one. Whatever, that's Tempest. But in terms of the way that Minter tends to approach his games, have you seen a picture of it yet?
Gun to my head, would not have guessed that in a million years.
Did you recognize it at all?
No, okay. Not a single frame.
There was even... It only consists of like five frames anyway. There's a version of it on Xbox 360 called Space Giraffe, where he kind of came back again back then in the 2000s and did a game called Space Giraffe, which was very much like Tempest. But either way, Jeff Minter, overall, the dude is known for doing really psychedelic, over-the-top video games that play immediately well. And Akka-R is just this thing where it's on like two levels and you're on the top level trying to defend various regions of a certain symbol against attacking enemies. But if they get past you, they go down the tunnel into another level and then you need to phase between the two and take them out in a more like twin stick kind of way. So you're planting bombs on the top level to detonate in waves that would catch the enemies, but if they get through, then it becomes a twin stick shooter and you take them all out on the bottom level. Yes, I sound high AF, but it's great.
This list is already getting off to a good start because this is a surprise. I have not even heard you mention this all year to the point where I actually can't believe it's on the list.
It's on the Switch, but you...
Because I doubt it.
Your Switch is in the sea, so I can't recommend him Switch stuff.
That is true, to be fair. That makes a lot more sense, yeah.
If I came in 9 a.m. to Josh Brown, Akka-R's really good, you would have melted or left the room.
That's a good point. No, you're right. It's wrong by me because I shouldn't be judging games based on their covers or one screenshot or how old they might be. Or may
also,
not be.
It kind of breaks my legacy rule of like not having remakes or remasters in here because it's not that similar to the original one just because technology has advanced so much. I do think it's distinguishable. If you compare the 70s version to now, it's hilarious. But it is one of those things where the guts of it were always there from like 40 years ago. But yeah, Akka-R, if you like immediate arcade video games, is really, really cool.
I rate that a lot.
Yeah.
I'm going to move to my number 10
Please
now.
Do.
Actually, I want to shout out an honorable mention first because Final Fantasy 16 isn't on my list, but that's just purely because I haven't played enough. I wouldn't know how to rank it in an actual list against other things.
I have it quite high on mine.
I've only played 2 hours of it, though. You've played way more than me.
I've played about 12 now.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Ish. Like, you understand what the game is, I think, a little bit more. But I want to shout it out because it will, I think, at least based on this early Dawes assessment, be on the list at the end of the year.
We will also do a spoiler cast when we've both got through the whole thing because there's already so much to talk about.
Yeah. But my number 10 is Hi-Fi Rush, which is a game that a lot of people raved about at the start of the year. And I jumped in, played for an hour, enjoyed it, and then just, for whatever reason, didn't go back to it. There was so many games this year. Dead Space was out, you know, shortly afterwards, that it just kind of dropped off. But after the effusive praise died down, I eventually went back to it and started plugging away at it a little bit more. And what a nice game. What a nice surprise. I can see why people were so endeared towards this because it does feel kind of like a video game-ass video game in terms of its mechanical nature, you know, it being a rhythm action game where you have to hit to the beat. The presentation of it, the kind of cel-shaded art style and the cinematically drawn cutscenes that have a real sense of energy and pace and personality to them. There's a lot in there to like. I don't think it's a perfect game, hence it being 10, and I imagine it probably won't be on the list at the end of the year. I can see it getting pushed out, but what a start for what I hope is going to be a franchise, and everything I like about the foundation in Hi-Fi Rush, I only want to see expanded upon in a sequel that can hopefully double down on those mechanics and really wring out every, you know, second of potential in them.
My thing with Hi-Fi Rush is that I really wanted more of either the licensed music or just different tempos of music because they stick to the same time signature pretty much the whole way through. And I kind of just wanted things that do, like, if you did like a metal DLC, I mean, there's a lot of like kind of fun horn throwing attempts at rock in there, very much like if a Fortnite character threw the rock symbols up, through the horns up. I can get on board with it. It's fun enough. It's very cute. And I did love my time with Hi-Fi Rush, but I kind of wanted something that would challenge me a lot more in terms of the time signature stuff, in terms of like the composition of the song songs, it just, after a while, it felt like I was doing the same kind of combos on the same kind of beats. But it doesn't take away from the stuff it does unbelievably well. Maybe the best looking game of the year.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's obviously the whole, get behind that.
Yeah, that whole debate around like fidelity versus art style. But if we're talking art style, nothing's even close to it.
Like, I don't think the writing in this game is perfect, no. But the world building combined with the world design, it just, it's cliche to say, it reminded me why I fell in love with video games, because it was so instant and it was so video gamey feeling, for lack of a better term, that I couldn't help but be really endeared by it. And yeah, I have a little bias because I really do like the developers as well. Yes. And I want to see them succeed. Mm-hmm. But even outside of that, I think it's just, you know, you can get it on Game Pass, give it a try, even if it's not necessarily your thing. Didn't think it was going to be mine. It might make a really good first impression, and I think it does.
Massive shout out to Tango Gameworks. My number 9 is Diablo 4.
Oh!
A game that I like a lot. I like it more than Diablo 3. It's just that it's so unbelievably repetitive that I can't completely sing its praises, because I'm very aware of how much the Activision Blizzard loot machine is just kind of abusing my time. I'm enjoying it, but I'm very aware of the clockwork mechanisms that pin me in place, and just sort of like trickle loot over me and go, you're happy now, do you want some more? And I go, yeah, okay, but it's never ending. I'm never going to finish it. Even if I finished the campaign, it would never be done.
Not trying to drop you in or anything. Please like do. That. I just remember you saying something similar about Vampire Survivors last year, in terms of it being kind of a similar thing, but the rewards being so thick and fast that you kind of can get into that loop.
Vampire Survivors is the Diablo loop, but without the combat.
Ah, that's interesting, man.
It just automates everything. It's like, hey, if you just want to just acquire stuff and just feel that rush, then fine. That, to me, at some point bottoms out.
Yeah.
But I get that, that's entirely what Vampire Survivors is.
I've never been a Diablo player. I really enjoyed playing Diablo 2 back in the day, but I mean, that was how long ago? 15 years, 20 years ago. So much so that I was...
Before what culture existed.
I was a young child playing that, you know what I mean? I had no idea basically what PC video games were or how they played, but I remember the art style of that staying with me over the years, and the fact that the art style for Diablo 4 is where I'm hesitant to say grittier, but it's darker, you know? It's kind of more heavy metal, for lack of a better term, again. And that appeals to me more than the art style of 3 ever did, which just wasn't my vibe at all. So I am kind of eyeing up Diablo 4 and the way it looks, the way it plays, thinking maybe one day, but I know how many times I've said that about a game before, just never got to it.
They do, I mean, for Diablo 4, like, they do have really cool ideas in there. Like, the thing that sucks is that it's constantly online, and if the servers go offline like they did on Sunday, you just can't, everything goes off. Even if it's a single player game, you're not with anybody in your party, it needs that constant servicing. The benefits of that are that they can randomly plug in other characters, other players into your world, and a random human player will just run onto your screen, maybe you emote with them, and then the two of you go off and do a mission together or a quest or whatever. There are also like random mini bosses that turn up, and you can just join another player and fight them together, get all the loot and everything else. It is like a perfect version of the loot grind. It's just that you're not really doing much else. The story in the world, like, the world's great, the world design is awesome. It's just that, and Lilith is a really good villain, and she's presented really well. The cutscenes are brilliant, the cutscenes are genuinely great. It's just that thing of like, it's really just go kill the evil stuff, there's not really much else going on. So, every side mission that I've done, and I'm about, I don't even know, 15, 20 hours into it. Like, I've played a lot of it.
Yeah.
And it's weird, because I didn't get on board with Diablo until this point. I always kind of hovered around 3. I bought like 3 copies of it and just never stuck. But now that I'm on the Reddit threads and the social media and everything, kind of just looking at other new players going like, is this all there is to this? And all the people going like, there's new guys.
What more do you want?
It's an extremely satisfying combat system. You get to do really fun character builds, and there's tons of loot that, just spits out of every orifice of that game. And that's great, but it only gets it so high on my list.
Interesting, man. Like, I'm going to be really fascinated to see if this penetrates a lot of people's Game of the Year list at the end of the year, because there was obviously a lot of hype at launch, a lot of people really enjoying it, but there's so many games this year, I wonder which ones are going to have the staying power, and with it being kind of a sequel that, like I said, is doing well, will it have that longevity in it, like Diablo 3 did, which, you know, was successful for a decade.
Still is now.
Mm-hmm. And my number 10 is, not my number, my number 9 is Wolong, which is another Game Pass game. That full clarity, I did not finish, but I did play for 30 hours. I have an issue with the developers of this game Team Ninja, yes. If I recall. I always get them mixed up with Ninja Theory because I'm terrible. Team Ninja, who made, you know, the Neo games as well. I also loved the Neo games, but didn't finish those either.
Finished one and not two.
Unfortunately, while the gameplay loops of their recent titles are absolutely stellar, as is the level design, they're just too bloated. Mm. And I get to the point where I've kind of seen it all, and I don't feel the pull to get to the end. I thought this would have been the one that finally got me into it, but after a week away, the pull just wasn't there. That said, the 30 hours I did spend with it were incredibly satisfying. If you're a fan of those Neo games or Souls games, which this takes a lot of inspiration from, I think you'll be right at home. This makes a lot of really cool tweaks to the Neo formula that I personally enjoy a little bit more, like kind of changes to a parry system, or you have different kind of stamina meters that you have to juggle this time around to get in attacks on your enemies. There's a brutal first boss that teaches you how to play the game that, you know, might stop a lot of people from continuing because it is just so hard and demanding. But if you play it on its own terms, there's a lot there to like. The combat is so bloody satisfying. The bosses are really, really visually interesting as well as really fun to fight. And there's a cool kind of, it's like essentially like an honor meter that kind of replaces the general level scaling that you have in similar games, where you do have leveling up that you do when you bank your currency and you can increase your strength and what have you. Mm-hmm. But there's also a kind of leveling up system that's happening in every level and arena that you're fighting in, that you have to continue to increase in order to fight the hardest levels within those enemies. So it kind of tries to onboard new players by saying, like, look, you don't have to think about all of these stats. Just think about getting this level high in the area that you're in right now, and you'll have a fighting chance, which I kind of appreciate. I think it's a really cool continuation. I just think it's held back by it being a little bit iterative for a next-gen game. I thought it would look prettier. I thought it would run better. And I just kind of want to see the next evolution from this studio now, because I don't think they can keep releasing games that are on this level, because it feels a little bit held back by the technology, and it feels like there's more they could do with this formula on a bigger scale. But that said, still recommendable, and if you're a fan of this franchise, a fan of those developers, and a fan of this kind of subgenre, you'll like it.
That's one of the things that I think was hard for me, was like I played the first sort of 45 minutes-ish. I did a lot more on the beta, the demo beta thing they put out. And I was just like, yep, it's another one of them. It's crushing me into a fine pace, and I don't have the stomach for it anymore. Whereas like Elden Ring, like obviously like over 100 hours or whatever it was in that. So I thought Wolong was really solid, but I was like, I'm starting to detach from this genre because there are so many of them. So I'm just going to like give it a minute. My number eight is Bat Boy, a game that is in my games of the year overall. Games that no one else is playing, if we're talking about stuff that's been overlooked in the year so far. From Sonzai Games, I just love this thing. I love old school pixel platformer stuff. Already sang this thing's praises on the overlooked games of the year so far, games that no one's playing so far. So I don't know what order these things will be going out in. I think this podcast will go out soon.
Yeah.
Yeah, this podcast will be going out this week. So if you like 2D pixel platformers and you kind of hold out for those really special ones, like a Shovel Knight, like a The Messenger. They come but once every 4 or 5 years. Yes, it's an extremely busy genre. It was the go-to for the early 2010s, but this is the one where if you're just keeping an eye on the genre overall and you do like a good tight 2D pixel platformer, this is the one that stands out. In terms of playing as Bat Boy, you unlock various abilities across the story, but you also have the ability to just reflect projectiles back at enemies. The thing that kind of gets in the way of this getting higher is the brutal difficulty. Ooh. Because that's what I'm expecting. It's what I want from this genre. I do like piloting my collection of pixels as my dude through an assortment of other pixels to get by obstacles, but the amount that this thing asks you to do on one checkpoint is brutal, to the point where you're doing like 3, 4, 5 screens of tons of enemies, tons of timing-based puzzle stuff, slowing time down to jump on a bunch of boxes whilst deflecting projectiles, all on one checkpoint and then being kicked all the way back. The fact that the levels don't have checkpoints if you go to a different game, you got to do the whole level again. And so like it's things like that where I was like, could you guys not have just give me a little save checkpoint or something?
Oh, brother. Like, it's I wasn't into this game from what you mentioned previously, just because it takes a lot for me to get into a 2D game, 2.5D game like this. But when you bring up brutal difficulty and
I'm speaking your language,
sparse checkpointing, I think I'm in.
How does that make you get in?
Man, because the games that I play in this kind of general genre are your Blasphemouses, are right. your Hollow Knights. So the idea that this has, you know, that level of challenge to it, that is kind of music to my ears, and maybe I want to play Bat Boy now.
Oh, it doesn't. Well, I wouldn't say it's not like Blasphemous. That's interesting you say it like that, because it does have that, it puts you in that mindset of like, I need to focus on every last bit of this. I do find it more surmountable than Hollow Knight, personally, and Blasphemous, to be honest. I think it is more timing-based. It's more like the later levels of Shovel Knight, or it's more like some of the harder levels in some of the Mario Brothers games. Like, it is just about specific timing windows and specific like paths through levels with like lasers and slow motion and everything else kicking off. But yeah, I think overall it's extremely well designed. It wasn't at launch, sadly. It took a couple of patches to get there. There were some weird sprite glitches where like some of the enemies were getting stuck in the environment or whatever, and your tool set wasn't as reliable as you would want it to be when the game's asking so much of you. But it's been patched now, and it's very, very smooth. But yeah, my number 8 will be Bat Boy.
I want to check that out. You've kind of sold me on that. There's a few games that you have mentioned and that you mentioned on the list that we did about the games that no one is playing that sound really interesting, and Bat Boy, you've just sold it to me right there. My number 8, Scott Tilford, is Dead Island 2. And look, I've counted my list, right? And 6 out of 10 games this year have been complete surprises. Right. They were games I didn't expect to see on this list at all, and Dead Island 2 might be the peak of that. I mean, how doomed did this game look before launch? Yeah. You know, it went through a bunch of different developers. It was delayed for over 10 years. No one had any idea that this, weirdly enough, was going to be one of the most polished, most next-gen feeling games that's out at the moment. I cannot believe we've had disasters like Redfall this year, technical disappointments like Jedi Survivor, in Dead Island 2, out of the lot, has been a pristine game to just pick up and play or recommend. It isn't like, you know, a complete 10 out of 10, you must play this game. No. It is a little bit archaic in how it feels. If you've played Dying Light or if you've played the original Dead Island, it's a natural continuation of that. But it's the kind of attention to detail and the bells and whistles that really sold it as an experience for me. Personally, I love early zombie stories when it's not, when the world hasn't devolved into a post-apocalypse, when it's kind of fresh, when you've got modern society as we know it now completely blood-splattered and going up against this force that is new and no one really knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. The kind of like gorgeous visuals of LA and the architecture and the level design mimicking real streets is just perfect for me, and the attention to detail within those levels made the sacrifice from it not being an open world game more than worthwhile. I just kind of constantly got lost in looking around these houses, looking at the environmental storytelling on display, looking at some of like the best textured toilets I've ever seen in my life. All of that stuff elevated what was otherwise, you know, a quite expected and uninspired mechanical loop. And it just worked.
I wouldn't have batted it. I didn't bat an eye to this game whatsoever until we got it in. We got early access. We had previews, reviews, and whatever. And then when you were playing it, and you and Jules were both like, no, this is actually really good. And I was like, what? And then I started looking at the footage for it. And I was like, this actually does look like it'll play really well. The gore system's really fun, like in terms of the technical performance. And all the, I don't know if it's ray traced stuff, but the lighting's really awesome. The various reflections through glass are really awesome. The first time I walked around like an empty wine glass, and it bent the entire like image behind it. And I was like, you guys have really paid attention to this.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just is this really fun zombie carnage game that like I ended up buying. I just went out, traded some games in. I must get this game. Dead Island 2 was one of the first things I thought of when I started building my top 10 of games that genuinely surprised me. It slowly got kicked down and kicked off my top 10 because I can't, Akar's right there. But like still, it's unbelievable how well this turned out considering the amount of it's in development hell, the style articles that did the rounds, and just how long it's been since Dead Island 1.
Absolutely, man. And I honestly think it's a testament to scale not being everything. You know, this is going to get obvious comparisons to Dying Light 2. Dying Light, of course, being the zombie series that was made by the developers of the original Dead Island. And if you compare Dying Light 2, which is way more ambitious. It's got this massive open world. It's got a bunch more mechanics. It's got an RPG story that allows you to befriend factions and make decisions. To me, that game crumbled under the weight of all of that. It kind of lost its identity. It lost its mechanical through line where it kind of became... And sorry to people who like this game, but it became an Assassin's Creed where there was a lot to do, but little motivation to engage with everything. Dying Light 2 isn't as ambitious as that, and maybe not even as impressive in terms of some of the stuff that it tries to accomplish. But within its smaller scale, it kind of just nails everything it sets out to achieve. And it reminds me of your saying of, like, what does the game set out to achieve and what does it, like, nail? Yeah. And to me, it kind of doesn't have those grand ambitions or those grand aspirations. But there's something to be said about a smaller scoped experience just kind of nailing it. And if as long as you know what you're getting in for, I think that's completely fine, especially in an era where we're struggling to get through 70-hour games. Just give me a nice 12-hour romp with some great zombie gore effects and some stunning world design. That's kind of...
Million percent. That was the thing that got me on it. I was like, oh, this is actually designed to be finished. Like, unlike Dying Light 2, where they were like, oh, it's 500 hours of gameplay or whatever. Yeah, this is just one of those really good 6/7 out of 10 games that is just easily recommendable. And just at the point where I was getting a bit sick of the melee combat, they gave me an assault rifle and I was like, okay, cool, let's just keep going with this thing. But yeah, it's worth shouting that out just in terms of games no one expected to be worth anything actually being really good. My number seven, and this thing, this is the last one in terms of overlooked stuff, for the most part, but my number seven is Theatrhythm Final Barline.
Nice.
Which was in my other overlooked games list that we did, that'll be going out as a proper video in the next couple of weeks. But yeah, Theatrhythm Final Barline, I think, is a follow-up to an old 3DS game, but it's on Switch, and it literally just is a very, very tight, very satisfying rhythm game, but the soundtrack is entirely Final Fantasy. They just let you play through everything from like Final Fantasies 1 through 15, all the spin-offs, all the like Crisis Core, Advent Children, all those kind of things. And it's just beautiful. Like, I mean, the music-wise, it's beautiful. Visually, it's not the best. They sort of had to compromise somewhere, or it feels like they did in terms of getting something like this over the line with Square Enix, who demand the most ridiculous expectations in terms of budget and everything else. So visually, it does just kind of look like a mobile game. It's kind of got like very simplistic sprites and whatever, but the things that you're unlocking in terms of the songs, you sort of get a key every sort of 3 or 4 levels that lets you just jump to a different game if you want to. So you're not stuck playing through like Final Fantasy 2's music if you just want to listen to 7, 6, 10 or whatever. And I love that approach. I love that you sort of do like 4 or 5 songs on a soundtrack that you're interested in, and then you start unlocking all the best ones all at once. And then if you want 100%, you can go and do everything else. But I just love, as someone who genuinely adores Final Fantasy audio footprint, it is playing all of that all in one go, all right there, is magical. Like, I mean, it's beautiful. Like, I had so much fun with this. I've almost 100%ed it. I need to do like Final Fantasy, like the old ones. I need to do the chiptune-y ones a lot more. But like, playing through Aerith's theme, Tifa's theme, Terra's theme from Final Fantasy VI, there's just so much here. Zanarkand from Final Fantasy X, like, there's so much here that is beautiful. Also, if you like the boys from Final Fantasy 15, Noctis and the boys, their little chibi versions running around fighting as you're playing is great.
Sounds like a game designed for you.
That's the whole thing. So in the background, while you're matching all these different rhythms together, your score is then visually represented by your party of choice attacking various enemies. So you can mix and match. You can have Cloud with Zidane, with Noctis, and whatever. But yeah, they're all just fighting as you're playing along to these incredible scores. And what else do you want, Josh?
Maybe when I finish Final Fantasy 16 and become a Final Fantasy fan, maybe that's the next port of call for me.
If it's not Final Fantasy 6, I don't know what else it'll be.
My number 7 is Amnesia the Bunker, which I've mentioned a few times on these podcasts already, so I won't spend too long on it, but this was another huge surprise because Amnesia historically hasn't been a franchise that I've loved. I like the games it inspired more than the games themselves, but this is a completely different beast. This is set in a World War I bunker that you can freely explore, and the puzzles in the game are designed around unlocking new areas within that bunker. You need to ultimately escape because you're being chased by a monster that lives in the walls and is attracted to sound. But I love it because there's so much more gameplay in here compared to the previous Amnesia games. This is a survival horror game through and through, where you have limited resources, you have a gun to scare off the enemy, you have grenades that you can even use, but which are obviously obviously incredibly rare. You've got a limited inventory. You've got one main save zone that if you die, you get knocked back to there. You have limited fuel for the generator that you need to turn on so you can see where you're going and turn on the lights and the electricity in the entire bunker. And it's just one of those games that has a cool setting that I cannot deny, combined with, you know, survival horror mechanics that I am an absolute sucker for. And I just hope, I really, really hope that they manage to make a sequel, either a direct or spiritual, to this game, because I want to see what more they can do. The game is kind of more of an immersive sim than it is a survival horror game, or at least it certainly takes inspiration from that, because the very opening text prompt you get is experiment. Whatever you think you'll be able to do with the items you can pick up, you probably can. You know, try to combine these items. Try to use this item on this enemy and see what happens. Or this item on this door, see what happens. You can kind of improvise your way around the game, which I really love. There is a procedurally generated element to the game as well, whereby each playthrough is different because it randomizes where items spawn and, for instance, the codes to get to certain rooms or open lockers and whatnot. So I haven't played through it.
There's a lot going on in this.
There's a lot going on with it, right? I haven't played through it a second time to see how impactful that is, but it changes, you know, everything, like I said, from those items to how the monster behaves and where it spawns. So I imagine there's a lot of variation within that. And like I said, it's a cool proof of concept. It is admittedly a little bit clunky. You can tell that the engine kind of feels its age in a way. I'm not sure if it's a new... I can't imagine it's a new engine, but I don't know if it's what they've used previously. But like I said, as a proof of concept, great. It's a great experience, and I can only hope they get to expand on it, kind of like Hi-Fi Rush with a proper sequel.
Something like Amnesia, we talked about this on the wind-up, I think, is just something that the bunker, the way that you describe it, does make me want to check it out. It feels like weirdly a good palate cleanser in amongst all these other massive games, because it's like, it is something that's designed to be finished, and it is, because it's horror, there's not much else doing horror stuff other than like Resident Evil, and even then it's a different style of horror anyway.
Dude, it was an excellent palate cleanser after 70 hours of Zelda, especially because, you know, it's obviously something completely different from a content perspective, from a tone perspective, but also you can finish the game in like 5 or 6 hours. It's really short. It's really compact.
Beautiful.
Without feeling too short or leaving you shortchanged, I imagine, because it has that replayability to it if you want. And there's a lot of secrets in there to find. So it was kind of just the perfect little tonic after indulging in such lengthy games.
I love a little tonic. I think if your go-to in terms of like perking up the old eyebrows is checkpoint placement, mine is definitely, it's less than 5-6 hours long. I'm like, oh my God, I can finish a video game. Like, oh my God.
Well, this is the thing, right? Because I know you'll love the length, but I do wonder if the checkpoint placement will make you run a mile, because the game does encourage like trial and error. Obviously, you're going to run out of fuel for your generator. You're going to get caught by the monster and get instant killed in some cases, and it's going to kick you back to the checkpoint, so you're going to have to retrace your steps.
I think that's fine if you have a safe zone.
That's it.
That's fine.
That's it. But part of the fun is almost playing it like a roguelike, you know, making those mistakes and then having understanding everything you need to do to get everything you need in that area and then just executing it perfectly. It just does mean that you have some frustrating runs before you get to that one that succeeds.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm very curious about this game. Number 6 for me is Final Fantasy 16, a game that I can't put any higher yet because I'm still playing through it. I also think that the way that this thing's rolling out, there are so many moments in it that are easily my moments of the year. Like, I'll just say boss battles and not going any more than that, but the way that they do scale, the way that they make a lot of the scale playable, and the way that they walk that line between things being directly controllable and then they do a little bit of the quick time events, a little bit of the cutaways. They call them like cinematic flourishes or cinematic clashes. And things like that, I think they do work in the moment. I get that those things are quite outdated, like obviously quick time events, whatever else. But certain battles are kind of elevated by them. And they do end in proper gameplay. So it's like you are kind of finishing the enemy off properly kind of thing. So, but yeah, Final Fantasy 16, it's still, like I said, I can't put it much higher yet because I haven't finished it yet. I'm fascinated by the story they're telling and the pacing that it has. And I've not really looked on fan communities and stuff too much because I don't want any spoilers. But the pacing they're going for is like this really weird Final Fantasy 13 style thing where it opens pretty strong. I mean, 13 opened a bit weirdly, but it then took like 20 hours to get good. Mm. Like I said, I've said this on other podcasts, but 13 has its fans, which I kind of view as like Stockholm syndrome because you've been around it for 20 hours at that point. So of course you're going to finally care when things start happening. But 16 has a very specific, deliberate, slow pace that, because it's kind of taking so much from Game of Thrones anyway, reminds me of the pace of like a mid-season Game of Thrones. And then things would always kick off in episode 9 of Game of Thrones. And it feels like I'm building towards that. And so it's been a lot of just spending time with Clive and with one or two other companions. And the character work is really solid. It's just that the story they're telling is very mysterious and is very sort of like trying to chase the truth and what really happened and whatever in terms of the inciting incident that happens in the, it was in the demo, but it's at the beginning of the game. And so I can't say that it's all round incredibly satisfying overall. I think the music is phenomenal. I think the depictions of combat, the depictions of boss battles, the combat you get there and the different modes that you go into are really, really fun and just astonishing on a visual level. I think the cutscene direction is absolutely gorgeous and I love the world that they're building. It just hasn't fully come together yet because of the way that the line they're walking.
Yeah.
It's like they're teasing this really big, epic, wider sort of world, this world of giant monsters and the kaiju-sized creatures.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Cheers, icons and everything, but we're not really getting there. We're doing a much smaller personal story. And that's fine. That can be brilliant. But then when you have certain reveals that are meant to mean a lot and they don't because the audience knows more than the characters, it's things like that I think could be done a lot better. So I'm curious how it goes overall. Yeah. And nothing where I am is definitive in terms of what the actual full story will be.
Totally.
It's keeping me hooked, and I really do love new Final Fantasy energy. So it's just one of my top franchises. But it's only at number 6 for now.
I would recommend people check out the wind up that we did this week.
Yes.
Where we went into this in depth that I've not played much since then. So I'll just say that it's been a long time since I've played a game, and even though I am early doors, where I don't know which way it's going to go, I could end up loving this thing, I could end up loving parts of it, or it might completely sour on me. And that's almost a unique energy to have, because normally you can get a feel for a game in like the first couple of hours at least. You kind of know what it is, or you know potentially where it's going. With this, there's so much to latch onto and so much that isn't my thing that it's the game that's released this year that I'm most fascinated to see where it lies because there's so much going on with it.
That's the thing. I'm like, I'm about 11, 12 hours in. I'm mopping up side quests because the game gave me a prompt saying, hey, if you do this, you can't go back. So I was like, cool, I'll do everything else before I go any further. And I'm still largely, everything you just said there is still largely where I am.
Right.
I don't fully know. I know I love Final Fantasy. I know I love the things that it's pulling from. I know that I've had various moments with it where I've literally been dropped jaw like, that's incredible. But that needle isn't pinned remotely or hardly ever, really, at the minute. So
I'll tell you what I know, Scott Tilton.
Yes.
That Dead Space is my number 6 of the year. And I feel like I've been harsh in Dead Space. Every time we bring it up in podcasts, I'm kind of a little bit dismissive of it. You know, you talk about like not having finished it yet, and I'm like, don't go back.
Yeah, you can tell me to not bother.
You know what it is. And I think that is valid because if you have played the original Dead Space, you know what the remake is. It's just a more technically advanced version of it with a few interesting new wrinkles, like the protagonist, Isaac Clarke, is voiced this time around and has more of an input in the story. They've changed a few of the combat encounters around. I do think it is better than the original, but it's unfortunately, it came out before Resi 4 changed what remakes
changed
could
your
be
life.
And changed my life. So I kind of think of it in that other game shadow. But still, Dead Space is incredibly recommendable. Mm. It is scary. It is fully next gen in terms of its visuals and the way it plays with lighting and reflections and all of that stuff, animations. The gore system in this is maybe not as impressive as Dying Light 2, but it's still impressive in the way that you're, you know, tearing down these aliens to their bones in order to sever their limbs.
It shooting their skin
grotesque,
off.
Grotesque, shooting their skin off with in some of the insane weapons you've got. I think it makes great additions to the original Dead Space in that this time around I was way more encouraged to use other weapons, whereas in the original and even its first sequel, the plasma cutter was king. It's all you needed. I don't know what they've done this time around to the resource management system and the way it doles out ammo, but it always felt like the other guns were viable and I always had a reason to use them. It's just, it's really solid. It's only dragged down, and not even really dragged down, by knowing what it is, because it is just a kind of standard remake, but a really good one of that. And if you haven't played Dead Space, go out and get it now. You will love Dead Space.
I love the sort of additional survival horror elements they put in there, like the bits near the beginning where you're choosing which fuses you're going to put into different doors, whether you want to power the lights or whether you want to power different access points so you can get more secrets and stuff. I think that's a great trade-off for a horror game to make. You know, do you actually want safety in light or whatever? That stuff was much appreciated.
Well, they kind of changed the Ishimura, which is the ship where the game is set, into an almost Metroidvania-esque location where you can backtrack way more freely now. And there's a reason to backtrack because they have locked doors that you can't access until you've got certain key cards from later on in the game. So every change was welcome. It's just in terms of could I recommend it to someone who played Dead Space 1 recently? Probably not. And that's the only thing that it has going against it, because if you've played Resi 4 recently, for instance, I would say you still need to play this year's Resi 4 because it's so different.
Yes.
But that's, I mean, it's still number 6 of the year so far, and I can see it being on my top 10 at the end of the year because it did make an impact.
Mm-hmm. But speaking of Resident Evil 4, my number 5 is Resident Evil 4 Remake.
Well, well, well.
I know this is a lot higher on yours, and we can get there as we get there. So I'll keep my thoughts brief on it, and we'll dive into it a bit later. But yeah, Resident Evil 4 Remake was something that initially, it was one of those games that I didn't know, I didn't necessarily want. I wasn't hankering for it. I always think if the original game is held in a really high regard, then why bother remaking it? Remake the bad games. Do a better job with the potential mechanics or gameplay ideas or whatever that were in there and make them work for a new audience or make them work in general. Resident Evil 4, the original, is one of the highly regarded games of all time, one of my absolute favorites. And I went back through it at the start of this year. And so, I mean, I'm nearly always going back through it because I have it on Switch. I'm nearly always just diving back into it. And so it was one of those things where I was playing through the remake going like, I don't really like the way this moves. It's not as snappy. I just like, it's dragging everything out. It's kind of doing like Final Fantasy VII Remake kind of thing. And then it just started to click. For me, it didn't fully click until I got to the castle about halfway through when you do finally meet Ashley, and then the story really kicks into gear, or at least the level design kicks into gear, and there's a lot more to do. There is a really good bit where you get a boat and you can go around the lake and you can manually find lots of different items and keys and everything. But for me, it was the castle stuff. And then once it kept the needle, I keep saying keep the needle pinned. That needle's pinned. That was when the combat started to shine, and that was when I started having to juggle more enemies and having to think about shooting them in the limbs and using the variety of weapons that you get and the quick switching that is in this one that wasn't in the original. and just all that kind of stuff, and how much better Leon and Ashley's relationship is, just the way that they talk to each other, and the way that Ashley's written in general is just so much better, and I really started to love that. So yeah, we'll get back to that. We'll get back to that because I know that it's further up your list anyway. What is your number five?
My number five is Dredge. Again,
that's my number three.
But is that right?
Yes.
Right. Again, we both obviously really liked, and we have talked about before, so I guess we won't talk too much about it today. But what a pleasant surprise. Yes. A lovely little fishing horror game that has you exploring a few different islands, each populated with their own mysterious characters and histories that you learn about. What do you like about it, Scott? Because I know initially you kind of loved it and then took a break from it. And what makes it higher on your list? Because I wasn't expecting that at all.
I always grade stuff. Again, it's that thing. What were they going for? What did they nail? And I always like a pristine package of a game where it's, you think about it and it's like not a wasted second, not a wasted frame or whatever. So for me, it was that perfect synchronicity between the art style, the atmosphere, the run that you go on after the beginning of the game when you start getting more ship upgrades and you start battling how long you can stay out during the day because there is like a day-night cycle. And you start doing that sort of beautiful, you're not even necessarily thinking about it, but like symbiotic connection between the player and the game,
yeah,
where you're going out every day, it's one more run, let me just go back out, let me see what I can find, let me get some fish during the day, whilst also some of the things that you're catching tease the darker side of the game, tease what's really going on, and start teasing characters or people that are missing, and like the characters will talk about things that happened before you were there, and it sort of, it builds to this whole idea of like, well, who are you and what really happened here in this like sort of dank Lovecraftian fishing village,
yeah.
And you just, I think it walks that line really well, and I'll never forget the run that I went on where it all just started clicking together,
yeah.
Where I started using, because you start unlocking powers as well, which I didn't know you were going to get, and when all that comes together, you're just motoring around these different islands. I almost said motorboating there, but I won't say it.
No.
Flying around between all these different islands, just hoovering up all, it's just a really perfect set of loops, and I was perfectly hooked on the story and the narrative in general, and the things that you were unlocking. I just thought that's, it was just extremely well put together.
Yeah, man, you talk about that flow, and when it clicks, it is, it offers a sense of escalation that just feels unreal. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're a regular listener of this podcast, you'll know that I'm an absolute sucker for games that allow you to master and conquer a world. And yes. I love that initially in Dredge, the days feel so short and it feels like you can barely make any progress in terms of the exploration because you can't get from one port to another without running out of light and having the day be over. You can't carry enough fish to make enough money, but when you start getting those upgrades in, when you start pushing out to the islands further away and you kind of feel more comfortable with your boat, with the environment itself, and with the amount of items at your disposal, the way it makes you feel powerful and the way it allows you to uncover the world naturally and then feel like the king of it, like you've been to all of these islands, you've talked to all these people, you know it inside out, you know the best routes to take. I loved how it unveiled that across its few hours of gameplay. Mm-hmm. And the mechanical mastery over that space was just as intriguing to me as the mystery behind the setting.
I respect the fact that I didn't personally like it, but I respect the way they handle their endings. I like the fact that if you don't go to a certain part of the environment at the right time, you will get the quote unquote bad ending and it will feel unsatisfying. And I ended up looking up some of the stuff to get the proper ending, and I was like, oh, that's way better. That's really, really cool. But at the same time, to some degree, a lot of the mystery is the horror, and that is what is so compelling and trying to figure it all out. And maybe never getting those crystal clear answers can be more effective anyway. So it doesn't necessarily need to be the bad ending. Like, it's just that there are two endings.
That's it. The endings worked for me. I kind of think generally I like that open-endedness and player-driven approach to finding the endings within the world, maybe a little bit more than you.
I was lucky enough,
though, that I kind of naturally, just the way I was playing, naturally stumbled upon both endings and could execute them at the same time. Like, I did the bad ending, and then I immediately reloaded and had the item to do the good ending and did that and saw them side by side, so I didn't have that kind of frustrating moment of, oh, I got one ending, how do I get the other? So I was lucky in that regard, but I thought the bad ending was actually better than the quote-unquote good one, just in terms of the imagery that you get. But of course, this kind of horror in particular is so subjective that it's you're either gonna like it or you're gonna be like, I need a bit more than that.
Yeah,
place.
Yeah. I think also like it's just worth shouting out that it is just such a unique little game. Like just meshing the fishing mechanics with this like horror backdrop, and then you start getting various powers and the different ways that you deal with the things you find under the ocean. It's just if you've got even like mild thalassophobia, they play on that really well. Where it's like, what the hell is that underneath me right now? Is that a giant set of jaws? All that stuff is extremely effective. My number four is Star Wars Jedi Survivor.
Oh!
I know!
The game that caused you nothing but pain is number four.
Well, that's
four.
The thing. It didn't cause me nothing but pain. But the pain was severe, and the pain on the performance mode was horrific, but it's not like that game didn't shine in it in spots anyway, and it's a testament to how good that game should be and the experience that a lot of other people had, especially on the quality mode, that it's up here anyway, because that was always, to crystallize it, the most painful part of playing through it is that you could tell it was a great game there. And when it worked, it was great, and certain levels were better than others. And that was when I started enjoying my time with it, where it was just, you know, you weren't stuck on Kobo, which is the more open-ended planet that you get towards the beginning. It was the more directed levels. There's a whole moon base that you go through that, thankfully, even on performance mode, ran beautifully. And that when it's doing its thing, where you're unlocking different combat mechanics, and even the combat itself is so slick and satisfying,
yeah,
and very stylish. I like a game that lets me be stylish. There's all that stuff to it, and the story focus, and the amount of different things they're pulling from in terms of wider Star Wars lore. There was a whole run throughout that middle of that game that I just blitzed through and loved it.
Hell yeah.
The performance mode got in the way all the time. But like I said, it's a testament to how much good stuff was in there that I managed to keep going. So there's still a lot to love about it, and I did still love portions of my time with it. It just kicked itself in the face every 10 minutes. So
I know, it's such
too.
A shame, because it's my number two, nice. So I might as well talk about it now as well. I loved it for all of the reasons that you just mentioned. I obviously had a better experience with it than you, because I got a version of it that mostly worked. Like, I had a few frame drops, but that was about it. Nothing game-breaking, certainly nothing that impacted my enjoyment of the combat, thankfully. Mm. And for me, Jedi Survivor just has this confidence that I want all sequels to have. It kind of makes the previous version feel like a tech demo, or a proof of concept. It's almost like you can't go back now you've tasted what they've cooked up this time.
Honestly,
around.
Like, so much of it gave me Mass Effect 2 vibes. I love Mass Effect 1, but in terms of like that leap, and it's like you're talking to the crew, you're going between different planets. Like, there was so much Mass Effect 2 in there.
Absolutely, would 100% agree. Can only echo what you've said about the combat there being so stylish, being so impactful, being so fun to play. Even this time around, I enjoyed the platforming sections and the explorative sections, which were really cool. Having these open but not open worlds where they kind of take a God of War approach, where you have these kind of like hubs, these big levels that have Metroidvania elements that keep you wanting to return to them to see what's behind this door that you saw 20 hours ago. Now you can finally open. I thought the story was great. The cinematic presentation of the cutscenes were excellent. It's just a really good Star Wars. And as someone who...
Which is rare these days.
That's it, right? As someone who could have gone either way on this, I enjoyed the first game, but, you know, this could have proven that was maybe a fluke, or maybe Respawn weren't cut out for third-person games. Nah, I can't wait to see how they raise the bar going forward, and I hope they approach it with the same desire to beat what they have established that they approach Jedi Survivor with. It's just a shame that it has those technical issues. And also, by the way, another thing that I loved about this game was how much fun it had with its audience.
Right.
Like, I thought it was a very funny game, and I thought that it would always kind of subvert your expectations and give you those moments where you just think, you bastards, you knew exactly what I was going to do there, and you've thrown this whatever it was in front of me to make me second guess myself. It has a sense of fun to it. It has a sense of personality to it, on top of being a really robust game.
My thing was, like, if you think about where Star Wars is now, where, like, you had the sequel trilogy that was divisive or whatever, wherever you come down on those individual movies, it's not, as a trilogy, it's not regarded as highly as it could be. Even the prequel trilogy is regarded higher. And it's one of those things, though, where, like, you think about what Star Wars is now, and they have all these different strands to pull from. Like, is it the brutalist in-between era between episodes three and four that, like, Rogue One pulled from? Is it the more prequel era where it's more, like, kind of goofy and the different monsters and they're making stupid noises and whatever else? That stuff was always in there in the originals, but not to the forefront. Or is it the wider sort of machinations of the galaxy that are in Andor or are in Last Jedi? Like, there's so much that they can pull from, and I think this walks a line between all of it, like, perfect. correctly. Like, this is a really good slice of modern Star Wars that isn't afraid of the goofier parts of the canon, but also embraces the more serious stuff.
Yes.
And I didn't even know that was possible, because Andor is way more in the Rogue One vein. And there's not like a goofy character in Andor. There's a droid, but like whatever. Whereas this has like a Scottish diving fish called like Scuva or something. there's that. There's the
Turgle.
Turgle. I couldn't think of his name. And there's like a talking frog voiced by the dude who plays Raz in Psychonauts. And it's like they're having so much fun with that stuff, but then they're not afraid of being really harsh, especially with who the final boss is and things like that.
Yeah.
That I just think all that stuff really, really works. So there's more that works than doesn't. It's just that the thing that doesn't work underpins the whole thing.
Yeah.
Thankfully now it got patched again last Friday, so it's had six big official patches, and you would hope that makes it playable. I've now deleted it, but I would love to go through it again genuinely as I played through it. When you're playing a game that has like broken performance, it's always like, man, I kind of want to do this all again because I'm getting this weird version of it. I would love to go through it again on a new game plus or something. So I'm curious about doing that. That was my number four.
Oh,
what was your number four?
My number four is The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom, coming in just outside the top three. And this is more personal opinion, completely subjective than it is an objective view of the game. I think it's a completely recommendable experience. I had so many five-star moments within it. I think if you haven't played Breath of the Wild, especially, you'll probably just think it's magic. You'll have the best time of your life. Unfortunately for me, it was just a little bit too similar to Breath of the Wild, and I hold that game up so high because of the revolution that it ushered in and how unique its open world felt at the time. That said, I don't want to dwell on the negatives, because Zelda Tears of the Kingdom has a lot of positives. I love the new powers that they introduced. I love the way it gets you thinking outside of the box for all of its puzzles. I love the two new areas that introduces, those being the depths and all of the sky islands. It has a lot going for it, and it hits more than it doesn't. Just in terms of personal love for it, I don't feel it as strong as I expected to. And maybe I just, my expectations were too high. Like, this is a game that I was looking forward to, avoided all the marketing for, bought a new controller to play. So I spent like £120 just on this game alone. And maybe if I allow it to sit for a few months and by the end of the year, I might think, oh no, I was a bit too harsh on it. But right now, in the moment, great game, fourth best of the year, just doesn't have the love like the it's in me appeal of the top three.
That's my Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom is my number two, because it's one of those things where I feel exactly the same as you. It didn't latch on as much as Breath of the Wild. It didn't blow me away. It almost couldn't, because Breath of the Wild was in itself this massive reinvention of this like storied IP with so many cool ideas. And I think also because it dropped in 2017, it just felt so fresh because it was an answer to the most boring corporatized version of open worlds that we were all sick of. So to do that again, and then the major new feature is the like ability to make stuff and all the different Zonai technologies and everything. That's fun. I think for me, it never truly doesn't feel like a gimmick. It feels like a thing that is fundamentally bolted on to Breath of the Wild. But overall, like I said, not to dwell on the negatives, I still have it at number two so far this year, just because of those five-star moments. Like, if I'm getting really serious about my time with the game, It delivered something every 10, 15 minutes that I took a photo of, or I took a video of, or whatever. I couldn't believe that something had happened. I couldn't believe they thought of something. And whether that was like down the story side of things, I love this version of Zelda. I love all the things that she does in this story. And things like the way that they handle the Master Sword, like, I love that stuff. It's playing off a history of the franchise in terms of the investment in those, in the iconography and in the characters. But they have a lot of fun with it. And they do elevate things cinematically that they've never done before. And the nearest being like Skyward Sword or something. So there are a lot of highs. I just think it's a fascinating game to talk about in a long term, because I feel like I absolutely demolished it for the review. I did like 70 hours in the first 4 or 5 days or whatever it was, in the first week. And it's just one of those things where it is obviously an extremely well-made game. It doesn't have the talents that Breath of the Wild does, but that doesn't discount it from still being immaculate.
Exactly.
It's just that it's up against a 100 scoring video game.
That's it. And if I didn't have this job where we talk about new video games all the time and we want to populate lists like this and we want to devour as much as possible, I kind of think I would have waited, because it dropped at such a hot moment where I'd come off my literally number one and number two games of the year.
Right.
So it's not just going up against my thoughts on Breath of the Wild, but it's going up against these amazing games that I absolutely adored. I kind of wish that I got to play it in a bubble, in a vacuum, maybe at the end of the year when there was nothing else out. But I didn't. I played it in this context where it had all of this direct competition, and it was still amazing, so I can't really complain also, too much. I'm eating well.
Yeah, I was going to say, the way the industry's rolling out, like, when is the next lull? There's kind of a lull in July, but that's about it. So yeah, that would be, that's my number two. That was your number four.
Awesome.
So my number three was Dredge, which we covered before.
Yes.
Your number three?
Is Stay Out of the House.
Something nice.
I'm going to be absolutely praising all year. I hope it'll be an amazing year.
This game's going to be something special.
It is, man. But I don't know if it's just something special for me or if it's something special in general, because if you designed a video game made to appeal to me, it would be this. It's a first-person survival horror game with PS1-style graphics that has a VHS grindhouse visual overlay on top. It is slow and atmospheric. It is not going to give you jump scares all of the time. It has a persistent enemy that follows you around the house. If you don't know, the premise is you are the victim of a serial killer and you're given 3 days to escape the house, and the killer has set up a bunch of traps and he is haunting the corridors looking for you and trying to scare you. You need to solve a bunch of puzzles to escape the house. Its visual style is amazing. It has an incredible sound design. The noise the serial killer makes every time he's alerted to your presence chills my spine, even though I've heard it probably 50 times by this point.
Right.
It's one of those games where I didn't know the publisher, who was called Puppet Combo, and now I want to play every single thing they have ever made. If you like retro kind of indie horror experiences, I would absolutely recommend it. I can't believe it's only £15. I feel like I've robbed them. I genuinely think, like,
do they have a PayPal?
Yeah, I'm like, I kind of want to phone them up and be like, are you sure? Do I not owe you
a little
bit more
money? I'll send it over.
I love this so much. It's a shorter game. It's about 7 hours long, or at least it took me 7 hours to play. Has a lot of similarities with Amnesia the Bunker in terms of its setup, its inventory management, even its weapon that you have to, it's a revolver, so you have to open the cylinder to check how many rounds you've got left. You need to empty those rounds slowly. You need to put the bullets in one by one to repel the enemy. It was a complete surprise. Like, I literally can't believe I'm on this podcast right now saying it's better than Zelda. It sounds like such a hipster pick to make, doesn't it? Right? But I genuinely believe in it. I think it'll be in my top five at least at the end of the year.
I'm going to have to play this game.
And like I said, yeah, you kind of do and you kind of don't.
I'm going to have to at this point.
It certainly won't be for everyone, but if everything I've said there sounds like your cup of Bovril, you should give it a try, man.
It feels like this year's Signalis in terms of a throwback thing.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
So my number two, like I said, was Tears of the Kingdom. Your number two
was Star Wars Jedi Survivor.
Yes, which leads it to my number one, which is Street Fighter VI.
Oh!
Just can't move the king. The king is sitting on the throne. The king fills out that throne and won't be moved. Street Fighter VI is just immaculate. I mean, find a flaw. Like, you can't. It's one of those things where you look at a veteran studio like Capcom, you look at how badly they treated the Street Fighter IP across the last 10 plus years, since Street Fighter 4. Street Fighter 5 was just this weird sacrificial lamb on the altar of esports, and it was completely wasted. It was a complete waste of a release, in the mainstream anyway. I know that the esports side of it did pick up enough. They still did a whole bunch of tournaments and everything else. Someone like me who absolutely loves Street Fighter overall, who was brought up on Street Fighter 2 and 3 and 4 and all the various installments in between, you were waiting for them to do something like this. And could they do it? That was the thing in the run-up to this, because the art style was a little bit divisive in terms of it sort of leaning into a Spider-Verse style or whatever you want to call it. I love all of that stuff. I love the sound design. I love the way even the menus are animated. I love all that stuff. I love that they did like a campaign, which is kind of like a Final Fight style thing where you're just brawling with dudes on the streets. You still play it side on. It still plays like a fighting game, but you're going up against like five or six other dudes or whatever. Kind of like the Tekken Force mode in the old Tekken games.
I used to love the Tekken Force mode.
I always wanted Namco to do more of that. They did Urban Reign, which is like a little spin-off thing, but they should do a Tekken Force game. Just Tekken Colon Force, do that. But yeah, there's just so much about the presentation, the intent. Again, Golden Rule, what were they going for? What did they nail? The three pillars of Street Fighter VI are the campaign, which is fun enough. A lot of the dialogue in there is really, really funny. And a lot of the things that you're doing is just an excuse to punch everyone in the face. You can run up to any NPC and just uppercut them to start a fight. And they all know martial arts. They all fight you properly.
Yeah.
So there's that. The middle pillar is the battle hub, which is all the online stuff where you're playing in like a big digital arcade. And while you're waiting for fights, you can just play old Street Fighters and other Capcom games. Genius. Absolutely brilliant way to do a lobby system. And you can also just sit at the digital cabinets and wait for someone to sit with you. And have like, you know, I was fighting this dude. We had like 20 different rematches because I would get three up. He would get three up. It was great. Like you have those little sort of like what you would have in an arcade, and it's like winner stays on and someone keeps putting their money down to keep going, and they nail that stuff. And then the other stuff is just the offline arcade stuff, which is like every character has an arcade ending, and there's obviously the tutorial side of things and everything else to get used to really like make sure that you know the intricacies of Street Fighter. Every single pillar works with each other. It just is this really great trifecta of Street Fighter-ness. And I can't get enough of it. It's brilliant. It's perfect. So that's my game of the year for now.
And you know what? Everyone seems to love this game. It's so one of good. Those rare releases where everyone just kind of comes to the consensus of, oh no, this is brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, Capcom haven't missed in years at this point. And
they're in the form of their lives right now.
Even as someone who isn't a Street Fighter fan, I'm looking at people enjoying this game with envious eyes, thinking, I can't wait until I can justify jumping on when there are fewer games or the game itself comes down in price, because everyone has just ridiculous amounts of praise for it. It seems like this franchise is back on top, and thankfully for someone like me, it also seems like the most accessible Street Fighter ever made,
which is
very appealing as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's the thing. They've prioritized that stuff. They obviously knew it was going to be a big deal. It's been 8 years since Street Fighter V, and this one comes with a whole new control scheme, like all these different mods. It's called modern, so there's a lot more easier ways to do special moves and signature moves, get you that shortcut to the really great screen-filling finishes that people want to do and people know Street Fighter 4, you know, in terms of like doing a fireball that's the size of the screen or doing like a 20-hit combo that ends in a slow-motion freeze frame or whatever it is. Things that people love Street Fighter 4 that I feel are just out there, like the iconography of the series was always kind of blocked a little bit because you then have to go in and be like, okay, it's like I need to roll my thumb twice left and then hold left and then do whatever. They've got ways you can get around that, but I think the beauty of that is that the modern control scheme hold some of the more complex moves back from you. So if you really do want to master it, you are then encouraged to learn it properly. And I find that they've walked that line really, really well. That's my number one.
Love it, man. My number one, we've already talked about it, but I'm going to gush about it again.
Please
Resident
do.
Evil 4. Another Capcom one,
funnily
enough. Two, even though they're completely different games, two Capcom entries for both of our respective number ones. That is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
If my number two, Star Wars Jedi Survivor, is how I personally want all sequels to be approached, Resident Evil 4 is how I want all remakes to be approached.
Ooh.
This is a game that I didn't expect to love as much as I did. Honestly, if you asked me last year which one was I looking forward to more, Dead Space or Resi 4, it would have been Dead Space, but this surprised me because Resi 4, like you said when you were talking about it, the original, one of the best games ever made still. Like, it still holds up. It's incredible. We were all asking, how can you even remake that game when someone can play it now and have a whale of a time? Well, apparently it's like this. It's remixing it just enough to feel modern, but still keeping the ethos of what made the original so good. The way they've tweaked the combat in this game to make it, like you said, a little bit more sluggish, but still incredibly satisfying
like
to
Red
play,
Dead.
Like Red Dead or Max Payne 3, is right up my alley. I like my survival horror games a little bit sluggish, a little bit difficult to fully master, and I love what they did with the lore this time around. Famously, the original Resident Evil 4 had a paper-thin story they cobbled together in the last few weeks or whatever it was, and it was just
you can really
thrown
tell.
In there. Yeah, you absolutely can. And that game works with that in mind, like it's part of the charm. But here, this is a more direct sequel to the Resident Evil 2 remake, and they make more callbacks to that, and they make the game overall a little bit more grounded, or at least more cohesive with its tone.
There's and not that bit where Leon goes on that weird platform with the giant wheels on it.
He's driving through the...
Thankfully, that's not there.
That's it. There's not that bit, but there is still a bit where he fights a bunch of knights with the plaga in them, and he says, nighty night knights.
That was the bit where I knew I loved this video game.
There you go. So I'm not saying like the story or the tone of Resi 4 is better than the original. Like I'm not even necessarily interested in saying which one is better, just that this is a good interpretation of it. It's a good different and both in my head like exist side by side as two of the best games ever made. Like, if Dead Space replaced the original, this complements it. And yes, it's just, when you finish it, I would encourage you to go back to that original and play that as well, so you can appreciate those differences even more. Kind of like Jedi Survivor as well. I also like the dialogue that it has with the player, because it knows a lot of people have played this game before. And even if you just play the opening village area, which is, of course, iconic and also in the original, if you try to do certain things you did in the original game, like go up the clock tower, it'll have a surprise for you. It'll make the floor drop out from under you so you can't exploit the same exploit you could back in the day. Mm-hmm. That open dialogue is amazing. It's very reverent to its history, but isn't afraid to do something new. And this is the only game on this list, like Elden Ring last year, where after I'd finished it, after I put 60 hours into a 15-hour campaign, I didn't want it to end. If I wasn't doing this job, if there weren't more games coming out, I'd be still playing Resident Evil 4.
I was
going to
say, you still finished it six times.
Yes, I
know. That's a hell of a thing.
Six times.
It's worth saying that from my side for Resi, I think when you said, like, oh, this is how, you know, remakes should be done, it is worth saying just how unique it is to pull this off and not invalidate the original. It feels like it stands right next to it. Yeah. And it's like, if the original was indicative of what would become all the trends across the mid-2000s with, like, the over-shoulder camera and the different approach to aiming and things that were already in, like, Operation Winback or Killswitch, like, this is that, like, it's that for now. It is the Red Dead, the Max Payne, the more weightier approach to mature video games. All the stuff that's so he's built their house on, doing that approach for Resident Evil. I love that they both exist and that one complements the other. One will make you curious about the other. And there's a generational appeal based on which one you grew up with, but they both totally work.
That's it. And they both have, like, strengths and weaknesses. You could compare them forever, you know. Mm. My ideal video game is probably the way the modern game plays with the art style of the original. But even encouraging those discussions is kind of fascinating, because like I said, it's kind of less interesting to say that one is better than the other, but to say, why did this take work compared to the way this take also worked back in the day? Like you said, they exist side by side, and that is really, really rare.
Yeah, it should be massively praised. So 10-1 for me is Aka R, Diablo 4, Bat Boy, Theater Rhythm, Final Barline, Final Fantasy 16, Resident Evil 4 Remake, Star Wars Jedi Survivor, Dredge, Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom, and Street Fighter 6.
My 10-1, let me get this back up, is number 10, Hi-Fi Rush, number 9, Wolong Fallen Dynasty, number 8, Dead Island 2, number 7, Amnesia the Bunker, number 6, Dead Space, number 5, Dredge, number 4, Tears of the Kingdom, number 3, Stay Out of the House, number 2, Star Wars Jedi Survivor, and Resident Evil 4 at number 1.
That is an unbelievable year when you start running it all down. Massive thank you to everybody for listening. Hopefully you've got some other picks that you can let us know about over on social media, and we'll be having a video version of the most overlooked video games in the near future as well.
We absolutely will. Yeah, tell me what other games I need to somehow cram into the schedule before 2023's out.
I'm going to get Batboy and give it to your face in the next half hour. But for now, this has been the World Culture Gaming Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you, and we'll catch you throughout the week.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.